This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
February 13th, the film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Barry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater. More information may be found at kboo.fm/Barry2013.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Now, I want to start off today with a quote from NPR, and this is a criticism. This is from David Green. Talking on NPR's business news, he said, and he was referring to the U.S. Post Office Saturday service closures. And here's the entire cut, a few seconds. While the threat has been out there for years, and now the day is about to arrive when letters will no longer arrive in your mailbox on weekends, the U.S. Post Office is about to announce cutbacks in Saturday service beginning the summer. The Postal Service expects to save $2 billion a year. Now packages will still come on Saturdays. They're a growing business for the Postal Service thanks to online shopping. Email, though, is a big reason for the Post Office financial woes. Now, that's the end of that segment. And although I understand that that was a news brief and that David Green, the host of the show, was not trying to give an extended explanation with that little excerpt, which is available on the website. If you look at that section on the website, and if you listen to what is being said on commercial media, you would get the impression that the post office is just being outdated. That's not true. I want to bring up, again, the fact that the Postal Service has been stuck intentionally with a bill to spike it. They are being forced to fund the pensions of people who haven't been born yet. They have to fund their pensions 75 years in advance, and the only reason for that is because the Republicans who pushed that through and snuck it through with the Democrats, who did their usual role of not giving a damn, intended to destroy the Postal Service so it could be replaced by something that is profitable to them and their the people who own them, and that's how Congress works these days. A fruit and vegetable handout in Greece led to one man being trampled yesterday, calling attention to the desperate conditions in the crisis-hit country. This is from Russia Today. Some 55 tons of produce was given away by farmers who were protesting high production costs. A person was injured when he was pushed by a crowd trying to grab the goods and fell and hit his head. The chaos was sparked when food stalls ran out of fruits and vegetables, prompting dozens of people to rush to a nearby truck. It was every man for himself situation as the Greeks shoved their way to the front of the truck, competing for the food that was left. The 55 tons of food was completely gone in under 2 hours. A Reuters employee at the scene was hit on the head with cauliflower heads as he attempted to photograph the situation. I bring up that news via Russia because I would like to point out that that is exactly the condition that our rulers would like to create here in the United States, because it's so darn profitable to have a desperate population. They'll work for anything. They'll work for nothing in the hopes that they'll get paid later. And as a matter of fact, a lot of that's already going on now, isn't it? From Al Jazeera, the U.S. government's internal guidelines for targeted killings of Al-Qaeda suspects allow for strikes against U.S. citizens abroad, as long as they are believed to be senior leaders of the group and still engaged in operations, according to a leaked Justice Department memo. You may have heard about this. The 16-page document released by U.S.-based NBC News Television Service on Tuesday provides a legal rationale behind the U.S. administration's use of drone strikes against Al-Qaeda suspects. The memo says that it is lawful for the U.S. to attack Al-Qaeda-linked U.S. citizens if they pose an imminent threat of violent attack against other citizens, and that delaying action against such people would create an unacceptably high risk. Such circumstances may necessitate expanding the concept of imminent threat, the memo says, quoting, "The threat posed by Al-Qaeda and its associated forces demands a broader concept of imminence in judging when a person continually planning terror attacks presents an imminent threat," the document says. The memo said that authorities did not have to possess information regarding a specific imminent attack against the U.S. It does require the capture of terrorism suspects first be deemed unfeasible, that any such lethal operation by the U.S. targeting a person comply with fundamental law of war principles. I could read more of that, but you can find it by using a search engine and or by pulling up Al Jazeera and having a look at that. And the reason I bring it up is, of course, this is, of course, totalitarianism. And the frog is boiled. It's over, folks. You may put me firmly in the camp of proposing a revolution. Let's get on with it, all right? Shall we? Some of us are going to die. Let's go. And right now, I have on the phone, if the electrons are working, I have Mary Liz Thompson, director, I think the director, and this is a very last-minute thing, of Who Bombed Judy Berry. And back in 1990, in May 1990, I was doing this program on KAZI Austin and another community radio station. And the news came through that a Redwoods campaigner had bombed herself. And there was so much hype involved that I immediately saw the similarity from the news releases to the news releases from the U.S.'s anti-Campesino campaign in Central America. And I and my friends said to each other, this is bogus. There's no way they had a bomb at all. There's no way they bombed themselves. This is probably COINTELPRO. And, well, you'll see. And Mary Liz Thompson, welcome to KBOO.
Hello. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I want to say again, this is all very last minute, but when I realized that I had an email from Daryl Cherney this morning, I called him up and he called back, and I called him back and he called back, and and this was set up. And so I'm very glad that you can be here. You are the director of the film. Well, tell us all about it.
Playing at the Clinton Theater on Wednesday, February 13th.
And that's so sponsored by KBOO.
Yeah, we've been showing it around the country. It was in L.A. and New York and in the Southwest, and now it's going to be in Oregon. It was in Northern California a lot. It was interesting that you mentioned the day of the bombing, because I knew them. I knew Daryl and Judy then. I was living in San Francisco. And they had been coming down to let people know and organize with people in the Bay Area what was happening to the Redwoods. The Redwoods were being clear-cut at an incredibly alarming pace, and people were desperate seeing this happen. The oldest, you know, the 2,000-year-old trees, the 30 feet around trees.
The magnificent skyscraper trees. The tourist trees.
Yep. So I had met them. They had actually come and played music, and I had some footage of them. I was, you know, active filmmaker at the time as well. And when the bombing happened, I just knew right away, you know, that someone tried to kill them. They were, you know, they were nonviolent activists who were setting up a summer of direct actions called Redwood Summer that was, you know, similar to Mississippi Summer that the Civil Rights Movement did. So I started filming them then, and I kept in touch with Daryl all this time and all the campaigns for Headwaters and everything. And I live in Los Angeles now, and I've been involved in the film industry all this time. So Daryl and I had kept in touch and decided to do this documentary, and we're really proud of it. We're really happy to be getting it out. It's such an amazing story. It's inspiring, creative. I mean, these are activists who use music and a lot of really creative techniques, but it took a long time. It really did. But you can win, too. They did save a lot of the redwoods, and a lot of people have no idea how that happened.
Now, because this is last minute, we'll just have to do our engineering on the air. Your voice is a little thin at this point. Anything okay. You can do from your end to speak a little louder? Possibly, if you're on speakerphone, if you can use the mic on the phone, that might work a little better. And
is that any better if I turn it up?
Just whatever works from your end, we'll try that, and we'll amplify it as best we can on this end. And but it's working. We're getting through.
Okay.
Well, I would like then to ask you to frame the event that brought this all about. There was a bomb. What happened?
A bomb exploded in their car, and there is still an open attempted murder case, and there is evidence about that case that we are still investigating right now. And in fact, some of that evidence is being taken to an independent testing lab today, which is pretty exciting.
Is that fingerprints or other material?
Well, what happened was this bomb blew up, and the activists were on a musical organizing tour for Redwood Summer. And immediately the Oakland police and FBI showed up and painted them as the bombers. Then they were smeared, and it really did impact a lot of the activism, made everything tense. I mean, it was an extremely tense time period. But they sued the FBI and Oakland police, and in the long run won a large case where they proved that they falsified evidence and tried to frame them. And that's really unique. It was a landmark lawsuit. It was a First Amendment case. But it was never proved who actually did bomb them then. If they didn't, you know, they weren't carrying around their own bomb, obviously, even though the law enforcement attempted to paint them as people who would be carrying around their own bomb.
It was a shocking accusation. It was a shocking bomb. It was full of nails. It just about tore her in half. We have spoken of this here at KBOO over all these years, and so many people know about this situation, but the details are just really shocking. This bomb full of nails just about killed her on the spot.
On it. Yeah.
And how she survived, I just can't imagine. And I've always said that the bomb killed her, even though she died of cancer years later.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious that you can't just be, you know, shredded like that and then get your health back.
Yeah. She was in constant pain, and it was really hard for her when she did get cancer. She did not have the energy and will to take all the chemotherapy and everything to fight it. She really had been in constant pain, you know, from the accident, from the bombing. So it was pretty amazing. Most people had that sense immediately, like, no way, this is ridiculous, you know. But it did manage to get out in a lot of the media that, like you said, that they bombed themselves. Like, you hear it, and then it doesn't get discounted for a long time. It's hard to take that back once it gets out everywhere.
Oh, yes, everyone thinks, I mean, that you remember the first thing you hear, especially in a sensational case like that. And to make things worse, well, I think it's very appropriate that this film is coming out now, because we have this situation with the Obama administration following on the Bush administration, just throwing away habeas corpus, saying that they are going to spy on anyone, bomb anyone, blow up anyone, kill anyone they want. And as I was just saying, it's over. We don't have democracy. We don't have freedom. If any one of us can be snuffed, then we can all be snuffed. It's I don't know what to say from this point, but it's relevant.
There's no due process. They openly can say that. And yet, you know, there were these campaigns where the political police inside the FBI, you know, were kind of took that on and did see it as their job somehow, or who knows. But at least they were implicated in protecting or hiding whoever actually was the bomber. And so, you know, what their role was, we really don't know yet. We're trying to find out. And there was a bomb that went off at a mill a couple weeks before the car bomb in 1990. And that is the evidence that it looks like it was probably planted to paint as a precursor. See, these activists were violent. They did this other bombing. But it only partially exploded. It didn't hurt anyone. There was like a paper sign next to it, you know, "We hate loggers" or something. ridiculous that activists wouldn't write. And that bomb was never tested, never fingerprinted, never DNA. It only partially exploded, so there's a lot left on it. And that's what Daryl and his legal team have been fighting for a while now. And we did get several, you know, they contested, but the court kept ruling in their favor that they did have the right to have it tested. So that could be a key piece of evidence that we're looking at right now.
And that's really encouraging. Well, you know, quoting from your own press kit, the FBI then used the pretext of investigating the bombing as a cover for a nationwide investigation of Earth First, sending agents to create dossiers on over 500 people whose only crime was to have received a long-distance phone call from Judy Darrell or one of 14 other people associated with them. That was felt even in Austin, Texas, where I was at the time. And, you know, here we see this. I think I can use this case and to get a clear view of the march of totalitarianism in the United States. It used to be that this sort of thing was covered up, excuses made for it, lies were made for it, and now it's just open. There's not going to be freedom anymore. So we kind of see how it happened and how bad it can possibly get if you're a nonviolent activist. And I think that, you know, it's often been said, but I do think it's true that probably the reason the FBI targeted Judy and Darrell was because they were bringing together the workers and the activists. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And a lot of people have said that, and I agree that Judy and Darrell both were able to work with the loggers and unions. The steel workers union was very supportive of the movement. And Judy did a lot of cases with loggers, helping them with sometimes medical issues and things like that that would come up, and organizing them into the IWW. And they had crushed the union years before, so it was even loggers could see that they were cutting their own jobs, that this was kind of a cut and run situation, and there wasn't going to be a future, you know.
And so the news, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the news today. Oregon is that schools that have been getting by on the federal dole because of the loss of timber are now being cut off, and the situation just gets sadder. But do go on.
Yeah, I mean, even someone with the Chamber of Commerce in Eureka at one point years later, you know, said, thank God the hippies did what they did, because we wouldn't even have tourism without that if they hadn't set aside headwaters and things like that. Because at this point, you know, the timber industry has basically done their small logging operations. There's even some disputed areas that they're still going after, and there's activists working on that. But at least the scale is completely different, and they have moved on. But, you know, it's deforestation that we've done just so blindly and allowed them to do is a contributor of climate change. It's going on around the world now in other areas. Finally, you know, Bormia, the paper companies, are being forced to look at that. But, you know, it's part of a huge factor of our abuse of the environment for years and years catching up with us. And I think what's inspiring about this case is they won a lot of things. It was really extremely difficult, but they did take things on both legally, and, you know, they did get money to buy headwaters for us from California and the federal government after years and years and years of trying. The lawsuit was won. You know, you can stand up to this kind of thing, I guess, is part of the message. It's not easy, and you don't always know. You know, sometimes we feel like as activists, if we just educate what's going on, something will happen. As we know, it doesn't always work that way, but you have to hang in there. You have a lot of perseverance, and it is inspiring to see some wins, you know, it really is. So given all that's going around us, it can feel so frustrating and all of that, it's good to know that, you know what, people like Judy Berry had a lot of courage and stood up every day and went out there and did stuff that made a difference.
She was something. She really was.
Yeah.
And I understand that you use her voice in her deposition just before she died, which is pretty darn dramatic.
It really is. She died a month later, so she's laying in a deathbed. And at first we were wondering, you know, she's so much weaker than she was in her life in this position, laying, recounting her story. But even still, she is such an amazing speaker and storyteller. And it really does work for her to kind of be the narrator, to tell what happened, to tell her story. And I think it's very moving and touching. There's a lot about the documentary that is not your typical, you know, just give you information and explain things. We have so much archival footage that we collected from activists all over the California who had been following them around at different phases. And it takes you there. You get a feel for it. You get a sense of that it works on an emotional level. You can really kind of have it unfold more like a dramatic movie. It's suspenseful and emotional at the same time. So it's really an amazing story.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing the film. So it's going to be at the Clinton Street. Remind me again what time that's going to be.
It's going to be Wednesday, February 13th. There's two shows, 7 and 9:15, at the Clinton Street Theater, February 13th. And it's also playing around Oregon as well. It's in Ashland and Selma and Eugene. It'll be in March at the Public Interest Law Conference. So, yeah, there's a lot of people in Oregon that knew about the story when it happened. I'm sure would still be interested to see. And even young people, one of my assistant editors, is a lot younger, wasn't around during the story, was so inspired to know that there are people out there who are doing this kind of activism. And it's a story that needs to be told. I think, you know, people have this vague sense of saving the redwoods, but really most people have no idea what that meant. Someone even said to me from Minnesota after seeing the movie, said, you know, I never really knew what a tree hugger was until I saw this movie.
Well, that really is persistence 23 years later, and I think you're to be congratulated for that. I actually realized, looking at the press notes, that I have a little tiny connection with your previous work. You were involved in Panama Deception, the film about the invasion and destruction of the neighborhoods in Panama. And at that time, I was with KZI. Let's see. No, actually, I think that was just before I was. No, okay. I'm sorry. I get my memory straight. Yes, I was with KZI, and I was doing my little show. And what I would do is I would tune in Radio Havana and make a transcript after recording it. And I passed on some information to your project. My name then was Steve Mitchell, and y'all actually credited me in the credits. The information was about the location of the burials in Jardín de la Paz Cemetery, the mass burials.
Excellent. I speak Spanish, and I've traveled a lot in Central America and filmed there, and I had some footage in Panama from the actual site.
Shocking footage, and it's still worthwhile seeing that. To see that was just sort of a weird practice run for U.S. Post-Vietnam Imperial Adventures.
It was so strange how it went down and what the real interests were with Noriega and all that. And,
all those years.
That's another complex story. God.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks again for doing what you have done with this film, and I encourage everyone to go to the, it's a KBOO event, Clinton Street Theater, next week, next Wednesday night.
And our website as well, I just wanted to mention, it's Who Bombed Judy Berry, and her name is J-U-D-I, so the I's have it, as Beryl says, and B-A-R-I, so it's Judy Berry, both with an I. And Wednesday, February 13th, check out our website. We have lots of events, our trailer. We've won 5 awards with our documentary, and we've had great reviews and Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Village Voice. A lot of places. So really happy to get it out there. So I hope people go see it Wednesday, February 13th.
Mary Liz Thompson, director of Who Bombed Judy Berry, thank you very much for calling in today.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Previously, I was talking about the Justice Department memo, which says that it's okay to kill Americans. The American Civil Liberties Union said that the document is profoundly disturbing. This also from Al Jazeera. According to the white paper, the government has the authority to carry out targeted killings of U.S. citizens without presenting evidence to a judge before the fact or after, and indeed without even acknowledging to the courts or to the public that authority has been exercised. That's according to the ACLU's deputy legal director, writing on the organization's website. And departing from that text and going back to the bombing of Judy Berry, well, that's pretty much That's similar to what was done to Judy and Daryl. Although the government carried out that targeted attempted killing of U.S. citizens and then presented false evidence to the media and to a judge. And so now we have a different situation where the U.S. totalitarian government is just arrogantly coming out and saying, we don't have to explain anything, and kill you when we feel like it. To those of you out there who are still real Americans, I say that we must now move towards revolution. We must do so as peacefully as possible. Possibly we can pull off this revolution without firing a shot. I would love to see that. However, I would like to emphasize that you, each of you, have an obligation now to, well, to take down this ugly paradigm that has come about as a result of the fact that we haven't, we as a society haven't examined our history. We haven't, we don't even look at the Jim Crow that we all profit, I say we all, white people like me, all profit from. We've been going around being Jim Crow and being imperialists and being corporate shills and allowing our U.S.-based corporations and U.S.-facilitated corporations to destroy the entire planet. And now the chickens have come home to roost. And, you know, we should have had this revolution some years ago, but it's never too late to do the right thing, is it? Returning to the document from Al Jazeera, without saying so explicitly, the government claims the authority to kill American terrorism suspects in secret. ACLU said that the limits set out in the memo are so vague and elastic that they will be easily manipulated. The document says that the use of lethal force will not violate the, would not violate the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution when a targeted person is an operational leader of an enemy force and an informed high-level government official has determined that he poses an imminent threat. Now, if you think about the language of the Fourth Amendment, you can see what hooey that is. But going back to the arrogance of the U.S. so-called Justice Department, the document says the courts have no role to play in the matter. Quote, under the circumstances described in this paper, there exists no appropriate judicial forum to evaluate these constitutional considerations. It is well established that matters intimately related to foreign policy and national security are rarely proper subjects for judicial intervention, the white paper said. And just a little background from the ACLU. The great writ of habeas corpus is a fundamental right in the Constitution that protects against unlawful and indefinite imprisonment. Translated from the Latin, and this is a related issue, habeas corpus is about imprisonment, and now we're going a little further than that. Past imprisonment to instant killing, but translated from Latin, it means show me the body. Habeas corpus has historically been an important instrument to safeguard individual freedom against arbitrary executive power. Our nation's founders considered habeas corpus so important in guaranteeing our basic rights that they specifically enshrined it in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution. But who cares about the Constitution anymore, right? Well, you've been listening to Press Watch, and coming up, Parafoggering, and much more information. And tune in next week for more news you're not supposed to know on KBOO Portland.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications, details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO. Well, coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, Flashpoints reports the National Day of Action by educators against standardized testing. Also, postal workers and their supporters, including KBOO Labor Show host Jamie Partridge, fight back against major cuts in the postal system. And the ghost of Judy Berry, activist Daryl Cherney talks about his film, Who Killed Judy Berry, coming to the Clinton Street next week. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Don Merrill interviews local novelist and former county commissioner Carolyn Miller about her work, publishing, and the writing process. And then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, information and interviews about books by Black authors. Coming up next, it's Fight the Empire with host Parafoggering, speaking with author and journalist Pepe Escobar. And that is next on KBOO.
This Valentine's Day, KBOO presents the Alfred Hitchcock movie, Rear Window, plus a pre-show performance by Portland's favorite late-night talk show host, Contessa de la Luna. That's Valentine's Day starting at 7 p.m. for Contessa de la Luna live on stage, followed by the film Rear Window. Doors open at 6:30 at the Clinton Street Theater, 26th and Southeast Clinton in Portland. Tickets are available now at Brown Paper Tickets. Seating is limited. 100% of ticket sales go to KBOO for this benefit spectacular. See events under the KBOO website for February 14th, Valentine's Day. See you there.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And our guest is author and journalist Pepe Escobar, and we're trying to contact him as I speak. And so I hope our telephone magic works. He is, well, let's see, his latest, he's written several books. His latest one is Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War. That was published by Nimble Books. He also writes regularly for Asia Times, which is an online journal. And I highly recommend Asia Times. It's got really interesting articles, and it's all free. And one recent article, which people might want to check out, is by a fellow named Kaveh Afrasiabi, and he's an Iranian-American. I think he teaches back east someplace, and he raised some interesting questions about this bus bombing in Bulgaria, which had been recently blamed on Hezbollah. Well, there are some questions about that, and Kaveh Afrasiabi raises them, so these are something to think about as we proceed. Things are not always what they seem. But you can find that in the Asia Times, that article was written on February 7th, which is today.